background, which you didn't touch upon. Oh, we usually go into that, how you met your wife, if you want to discuss your courtship and how it came about and when you got married.
Well, let's see. I met my wife when I was going to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and my wife was going to Goucher College. She is a native Baltimorean, and I met her on a blind date, as a matter of fact. And I guess I didn't call her for a month after I met her. I guess I was a fairly shy guy, and I didn't go on many dates. But once you meet somebody, it becomes comfortable, you know, to see them again. But I'm not sorry. Anyway, I've forgotten when I met my wife. I guess it must have been in the I graduated in 42. When did we meet, Deb?
When? October 17th, 1941. Did you remember that it was going to be a big
That's before? Being recorded. This is all going on tape. Wife to be.
She remembers it.
Was it 1941? Right.
Let's see. We were actually married in 45, June the 24th of 1945. And my wife, after she graduated from Goucher, went on to graduate school at Yale. We were married just before she started, I guess. No, she had already been, she was already in at Yale. And we were married while she was at Yale. We were actually married in New York. And so she continued on at Yale for the rest of the year. And then I guess I was responsible for convincing her that she ought to leave, although she got her master's and had almost completed her coursework for her PhD. This was in chemistry, by the way.
Same field that you're in.
Right. And then she came back to Baltimore, and she got a job at Johns Hopkins, in which she was teaching and also assisting in the project that I was working on. While I was at Johns Hopkins, between 1942 and 45, I think I mentioned earlier that I was working on this gun barrel erosion. Mm-hmm. And Ellen worked for the director of the project, a fellow named Burford. Well, from there we came to Pittsburgh. We had our first child just July the 11th, 1948, and I started here at Westinghouse August the 16th, as I've mentioned, 1948. And my wife worked for, I think, 8 months into pregnancy. Almost to the last day. And my mother was visiting us, and I was interviewing at the time. Forget that. I was interviewing at the time at Yale, and I was offered a job at Yale, as a matter of fact. Did I mention that earlier? I don't
know. No.
I was offered a job as a assistant professor at Yale, and I think they wanted to pay me something like $3,500 or $3,600 a year, which was good pay for an assistant professor in those days. And then I was slated for an interview at Syracuse University, and I was about to go there, and in the meantime, I had gotten an offer from the Davison Chemical Company, which is part of W.R. Grace, and I had also, I don't know whether by that time I had gotten an offer from Westinghouse, or I was about to go out there, but anyway, my mother said, look, you have responsibilities. You have to feed your wife and your kids. And what are you going out to the university for? And I was offered, let's see, I guess, at Westinghouse I started in 48 at the grand sum of 450 dollars a month.
That's important to record because, by comparison, today a 1984 postal worker starts at $18,000 a year at the lowest level. So that's for history.
Well, that was really a grand sum in those days. $450 a month, and I remember I bargained with the guy. He offered, his first offer, as I recall, it was $425 a month, and I said, no, I had an offer from W.R. Grace, you want me to come to Westinghouse, you're going to have to pay me the same amount that W.R. Grace, well, at that time, the Davison Chemical Company, and I won't come unless you do. So,
this is exciting, that was, what he's talking about.
That was when I got started.
Well, in those days, that really was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money, right.
Do you think...
But incidentally, when I was working at school, during the war, between 42 and 45, I eventually worked up to a salary of... $2,400 or something like that.
A year.
And then subsequent to that, I got a fellowship from a Indiana Oil Company fellowship, and that paid me $1,800 a year.
$1,800. Hard to believe.
For the tuition and everything.
Would you like to take a guess? Here we are in 1984. What do you think salaries will hit in the year 2000? Let's say basic salary. Take the postal worker who starts at $18,000 today. Would you try to estimate what he's going to get paid?
Let me say this, that if our inflation went up by, 10% per year, it would only take 7 years to double. So you can figure it out.
Why is it all through your life and mine too, prices, everything has gone only up? They have never reversed themselves, have they?
Well,
basic things.
During the Depression, prices went down, way down. As you may recall,
that was what year? 19.
Well, in the
20s.
During the
30s. Was that the 30s?
Was that before your day?
No, I can remember it.
Anyway, during the 30s, prices went down, but since that time, certainly prices have gone up. But I think, you can talk a great deal about the reasons for inflation. In my own view, it's due in large measure to what I call the Moore syndrome. You know, everybody wants more. The people in the companies want more. The officers have to demonstrate that they're doing better, so they have to charge more prices. I mean, if they're not selling more, well, in order to get more profits, they have to charge more. And there are many instances that we can point to where, in spite of the fact that there have been many surpluses, steel was one of them, automobiles. There was a time when they weren't selling automobiles. You would think that the law of supply and demand would say that the price of automobiles would drop and the price of steel would drop. But in anticipation of the possibility that there might be price control, you recall they raised the price of the automobiles, they raised the price of the steel, and that's what's been happening to a large degree. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of the government spending more money or overspending. What the government spends, it spends because it has to buy certain goods and services, and if the goods and services rise in price, they're going to have to pay more for the same good and service.
Well, how do you feel about the union's influence? The union's demand increases in the wage.
Saying it's the Moore syndrome. The workers want more, and therefore the unions ask for more. Management isn't beyond it either, you know. So everybody wants more, more,
catch
more,
22.
The union guy's not going to pay his dues unless his boss is going to get him more.
Well, how do you feel about Israel's...
Well, the crazy part of it is that what they should have been pushing, in my view, is that more means what you can buy for your dollar, not necessarily more dollars. However, that's
quality,
an old...
Which is not, you know, not with us.
That I'm not... I guess I wouldn't be considered by an economist to be qualified.
That was your tape that went off. Since we're talking about economics and the rise in prices, and you've been to Israel, how do you explain Israel's inflation, which is supposed to be out of bounds?
Oh, I really don't know how to explain Israel's inflation. Part of it, of course, is that and probably the largest part is the fact that they have had to purchase one third of their budget is devoted to defense,
right.
And they've had to purchase all of these things, and so the government has printed money. You can tax people, and that's what they've done. They've taxed them to the hilt, and also the standard of living has risen in Israel, so that they've purchased a lot of material from overseas, and there are a lot of good reasons, I guess, for Israel's inflation.
Well, the war effort is most important, which leads me to my last question. How do you feel about Israel's war readiness in the face of the Arabs that surround them getting all this war material from the United States? In other words, the Arabs are being supplied with the latest in planes, equipment.
I'm very nervous about it. As a matter of fact, what worries me is that there was a considerable technological gap between the Arabs and Israel at one time, and that probably accounted for their ability to overcome such a massive majority or massive Arab population. But right now, obviously, as a result of the fact that we've been putting money in the Arabs' pocket by purchasing oil at highly inflated prices, they are now able to buy all of the latest gadgets and a tremendous proliferation unknown to mankind before. And in addition to that, they're purchasing education. Not only by setting up their own educational institutions, but by sending people over here. And the Arabs are becoming much more prepared, not only with more material, but technologically. And so the gap that existed previously is narrowing very very dramatically, so far as I'm concerned, and I'm very worried about it.
Do you feel that Israel may have nuclear resources that the Arabs don't have? Of course, nobody speaks about that. Isn't publicized.
I don't know that Israel has nuclear resources that the Arabs don't have. I think they have. Israel has a lot of scientific and technological skill, and given the resources, I suspect they could do whatever we've done here. But Israel certainly doesn't have the kind of money that is required to build up a massive capability that we built up.
Then you think it's just speculation that Israel does have a nuclear bomb?
I think it's all speculation. What I'm doing is speculating as well.
Okay. All right.
I think they would like the Arabs to believe that they have the capability. It probably has acted as a deterrent to a degree. But even if they had a bomb, what would they do with it?
They could point it at their enemies.
And then what?
I don't know. It's not working in Europe. They have it all pointed at Russia.
Well, you know, it's a futile game, this whole thing. They could, you know, if they were on the point of being wiped out, they might be able to use such a device. But on the other hand, I suspect that it would simply result in their being wiped out themselves, because the Russians would undoubtedly enter the picture.
Right.
So I still would wonder what they could do with it, even if they had it.
So in finishing this area we're covering, would you like to say something about Israel's condition? Good, I mean, in what respect are they prepared for the next move that the Arabs are likely to make?
Gee, I haven't the slightest idea. In what respect? I'm worried about it, as I said, for the reasons that I mentioned. In addition to that, they've had to cut down their own budgets in order to try to curb inflation. And the result is that their military capabilities are suffering. You know, you can't practice as much. And incidentally, in giving away the Sinai, that has hurt their military capability terrifically. Mm-hmm. Giving away the Sinai hurt their economy tremendously too. That was, you know, they're spending, I think, about $2.5 billion a year for oil. I think that's the number. That's a tremendous part of their total budget. Whereas they had that oil previously in Sinai.
Right.
And they just gave it back. You know, people, they talk about Israel making sacrifices for peace. Israel has sacrificed a tremendous amount for peace, and the world doesn't seem to, and many of our Jews don't seem to appreciate what Israel has done for peace.
Right.
But in any event, I'm worried about that. They don't have the airspace in which to practice anymore. They had the Sinai, they had the airspace. They don't have the money, they don't have the oil, they don't have the resources to do what they've done previously. So it's a very worrisome situation, to say the least.
Is there some questions you have?
Notice that you and Mrs. Shapiro just gave an endowment, am I correct?
Yes.
To education?
Yeah, Orthodox Jewish education.
Orthodox Jewish education. In other words, you believe that the foundation still is education?
The foundation, you mean for Judaism?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. I have no other, what other way is there?
You feel it comes in the Orthodox area?
I mean, education?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me... Orthodoxy is essentially anti-revisionist, right?
Yeah.
Okay. If there weren't any orthodoxy, if we didn't have orthodoxy, you can call it orthodoxy in Christianity, orthodoxy in Judaism, orthodoxy in anything, what happens is that there is deviation from original principles. Now, you can believe or not believe in those original principles, and those people who deviate, obviously, revise as a result of their feeling that things ought to change one way or the other. After a period of time, any resemblance to the original would be purely coincidental. And you wouldn't have a base from which to operate. Judaism, as it was, would be recognizable. You know, if you look at it, let me put another different perspective. During the Nazi era in Germany, schools were changed, courses were changed, curricula were changed. The whole judicial system was changed. Their laws, their ethics, their morals, etc. Everything was altered. And if they were allowed to continue, in effect, there would be absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to anything that we know today, it seems to me, in terms of a fair judicial system. Man's relationship with man, etc. Well, the basis for orthodoxy is the Bible and the Ten Commandments, etc. And I think that basis has to be preserved. And even though there may be some modification during the ages by some revision of ideas, deviation, at least there is this basic position around which all of this tends to turn, so that in effect you have an anchor to a position which one can hold to, in spite of the fact that there may be modification. The original concepts still are in existence. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, many young people, have felt that it makes more sense to go back to those concepts than to stay with either reformed or conservative concepts.
That's beautifully stated. You sold me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I never heard it put that way.
You wouldn't call Israel a religious state.
No, Israel isn't a religious state.
Not
I didn't intend to say that it
no,
was
no,
a religious
no, no, no,
state.
No, no.
What it has done, Israel has done, is that it has given a greater importance to religion in its activities than we would otherwise have. For example, the Jewish holidays are national holidays, and people observe them one way or another. That is, they don't necessarily observe them in an orthodox way, but they are observed. The religious party sees to it that there are certain things which are done. For example, you do have kashrut in all of the hotels. And you don't have buses in Jerusalem on Saturday. And so, while it is not a religious state, there is some relationship of of religion to governance in Israel. And while it has had some bad features, it's also had some good features. So, you know, it's like many other things. You have to you compromise to get certain benefits.
May we go back for a moment to when we were talking about nuclear power? Would you then, it would be your conclusion then that nuclear power is more good than bad?
Oh yes. Oh yes. Look, the fact of the matter is that if you look at uranium or thorium, those things that could be used for generation of nuclear power, these things are basically not much good for anything else, but they are marvelous for the production of power. As I say, they produce power cleanly and small amounts, and produce large amounts, huge amounts of power. The amount of waste that is generated is minuscule compared to the amount of waste that is generated in the use of fossil fuel, coal, and so on. You know, there are tons of ash and CO2 and other noxious things which go into the environment, and nuclear power doesn't do that. Now, granted, just like everything else, what you've got to do is to do what you do safely. You have to be mindful of the hazards and the, as well as the benefits. And, you know, it's just like any medicine. Medicine has side effects. And if you take medicine in the wrong way, you're going to suffer from it. You can. So you have to do these things properly. And nuclear power has to be. The plants have to be designed and operated in a thoughtful, safe manner. But there's nothing that says it can't be done. It has been done. It's been demonstrated. But we have a navy, a nuclear navy. You don't hear anybody yelling about the fact that there are submarines going in and out of harbors or nuclear surface vessels going in and out of harbors. Occasionally you hear the Japanese protested going into a harbor. But in the United States, you've probably been to Florida. And what's the...
Key West?
Not Key West, it's...
Port Everglades.
That port there.
Port Everglades.
It's not right there. It's another one between Miami and...
up the coast.
Up the coast.
Not Everglades.
Anyhow, it's a submarine base, and you go to by there and you can see these things sitting there. Nobody makes any fuss about these
and
things.
Nobody protests.
Now, these don't have the same kind of protective devices and protective environment that a nuclear power plant has that produces power for peaceful purposes. They're operated very well. They're basically very safe devices.
We've never heard that before. I've never read that argument, pro-nuclear.
Well, I don't know that it's a... All I'm saying is
it's a good argument.
People would not say we should eliminate nuclear power for our Navy, because what that would do immediately is to put us at a tremendous disadvantage.
I see.
Okay, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Would. Certainly it would. There's no question here. The Russians are running around with a nuclear Navy, and it gives them tremendous advantages if we didn't have something of a comparable nature. Well, these things have operated, hundreds of them have operated very, very safely over many, many years.
Right.
And there's nothing that says that nuclear power plants can't do the same. I feel it's a disservice to humanity to have done what they've done in destroying this capability.
Well, Three Mile Island is what set the hysteria off, don't you think?
There was hysteria prior to that time.
Really?
Three Mile Island was a good basis for what they considered to be a demonstration of the unsafe aspects of it. And yet, through my allowance, we demonstrated how safe nuclear power can be, because in spite of the fact that this was a serious accident, there was no harm done.
No,
there was no radioactivity that escaped any consequence. And it demonstrates that the design can contain the material, and furthermore, that the automatic devices which are installed in nuclear power, if left to their own devices, will in fact stabilize the plant, which is what happened.
Getting
what they did was they turned it off. Somebody.
You say you are now doing consulting work?
Yes.
This means that you are now ready?
I'm retired.
You're retired. Is there any thought in your mind of moving to Israel?
Yeah, we've thought about it.
Yeah.
We are ready to go off the air again.
Well, anyway, we've thought about it many times, and we've thought about buying an apartment. We may still do so. I'm not sure.
You sound contented with what you're doing then?
I don't know that I'm ever contented with what I'm doing.
You're always looking for something more.
Right.
Do you want to sign it off?
That does mind.
I hope. May we thank you.
Well,
we appreciate it.